Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 4th of January. At 11 o'clock today, Central Time, the Democrats take power in Congress. And our guest, the first part of this hour, says the 2006 election marked the first time since 1954 that contest allowed, as this one did, both houses switching from Republicans to Democrats. And this allows new Democratic majority, in principle at least, according to E.J. Dionne, to come in with no commitments to doing business as it was done in the immediate past. He says if they don't seize this rare opportunity, the party will pay for a long time. We'll talk about how and about what's on their agenda and when that 100 hours starts and some of the key figures in all of this. We're going to be speaking with E.J. Dionne and a little bit later this hour with the economics editor of Congressional Quarterly. E.J. Dionne writes, of course, the twice-weekly op-ed columns for The Washington Post, and you also hear him frequently offering, I think, terrific political commentary on National Public Radio. His Post column is syndicated. It appears in more than 90 newspapers in the country. He joined The Post in 1990. His best-selling book, Why Americans Hate Politics, was published in 91. He spent 14 years with The New York Times reporting on state and local government, national politics, and he also reported from Paris, Rome, and Beirut. His second book, They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Agenda, was published in 1996. And his third book, Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge, was published in 2004. In 96, Dionne joined the Brookings Institution as a senior fellow in the Governance Studies program and began teaching at Georgetown Public Policy Institute. As a university professor in the Foundations of Democracy and Culture in the fall of 2003. And in case you want a reference for our conversation today, he caught our attention because of a column. Well, he always does, but a column in the Post on January 2nd looked at this new Congress. We'll be welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 227-2050, 227-2050. E.J. Dionne, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, and thank you for that generous introduction. It's better than the one I got the other day. And now for the latest dope from Washington, here's E.J. Dionne. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. But first things first, you got a dog for Christmas.
And we did. Well, we got a dog. Our kids had been lobbying us for a dog for a long time. And we had some neighbors who rescue dogs, and they called us about a month and a half ago and said they had the most beautiful litter of dogs that had come up from North Carolina, as it happens. And Casey, as we have called her, was a gorgeous dog. And so I was the holdout, and even I kind of melted when I saw this dog.
Yeah, and a year from now, you're going to love that dog more than anybody in the family.
Actually, it's a very affectionate dog. So we picked this one in the litter because she was the one who came first to our kids and started jumping.
Have fun. I love dogs. That's good. All right, so today they take power. What do you mean when you say they can remake their own image and Congress's image and they can begin to restore public confidence in government? They can do all that?
Well, they can start. I mean, it's going to be a very long process. I think if you look back at this election, the overriding factors were President Bush's unpopularity and the growing unpopularity of the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. But along with that was a great revolt against the corruption that had become obvious in the last Congress with the Abramoff affair and the Foley scandal and a whole series of other, the Tom DeLay's problems, a whole series of influence peddling problems. And so I wrote that column ahead of time because I think it's really important for Democrats to understand that they have to behave as reformers in this Congress, because that is what a lot of voters, particularly the independent voters, not quite so ideological voters, people who were sort of like the people who supported Ross Perot back in the 90s, really want them to take some steps. I think the good news so far, I wrote that before the ethics package was formally announced, the Democrats in the House have put forward quite a strong ethics package. And now the question will be, do they create the means within the Congress to enforce it? I just think that if they don't stand up for ethics after they're elected the way they talked about ethics before they were elected, they're going to have some problems. They seem so far to know that.
Yeah. You note in the article that eight districts were won by the Democrats because of corruption issues.
Well, you know, what's very interesting is Rahm Emanuel, who was the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, now he's chairman, chair of the caucus in the House, the Democratic caucus, is a very, very practical political guy. This is not someone you'd accuse of being a wild-eyed idealist. And he wrote a very strong memo early on to his colleagues saying, you know, if we don't take ethics seriously, we've missed the whole point of this election. And he went through the races in the last election and could point to eight out of the 30 gains, eight districts, where very, very clearly ethical issues were predominant. He could also point to a number of other districts that Democrats won where ethics was an issue. And so I cited that memo to make the point that, well, those Democrats who aren't entirely enthusiastic about reform on the merits ought to be enthusiastic about reform if they want to hold on to control of the House in 2 years.
So tell me about what they've put together. What have they fashioned in terms of ethics, lobbying, et cetera?
Well, they've got a lot of bans on sort of on lobbyist-sponsored travel, quite strong bans on lobbyist gifts, on using corporate planes. They've instituted a procedure where if you're accepting any kind of travel, you have to go through an ethics process to get the travel approved. They have also, they're going to have a lot more disclosure requirements on lobbyists so that voters, the public, the press will know more about what lobbyists are doing, what they're supporting, how they're spending money. And as I mentioned in the column, Fred Wertheimer, the veteran reformer here in Washington, who's president of a group called Democracy 21, has suggested that lobbyists be responsible, have to report on those earmarks, those special spending and tax provisions they sneak into bills, to talk about who is behind the earmarks. And it's the reason I found that intriguing is a lot of conservatives are very critical of earmarks. It seems to me that having as much information out there as possible about earmarks is a way to stop the ones that aren't justified.
Yeah. E.J., what are they going to do about Iraq?
Well, this is a very tricky problem. I'm writing my column for tomorrow, in fact, about that, right before and after your call. And I think constitutionally, the president holds a lot of cards. It's really very, very difficult to stop the president if he is insistent upon escalating the war or keeping it going indefinitely. And I think cutting off funds for the war is not something that would pass right now, and it's a very blunt instrument. I think if the war drags on for another 6 months or a year without a change in course, that will become a more popular option. And so there's a lot of discussion of how could Congress pass, initially, say, a resolution against a surge in troops if that is what the president proposes, or a strong resolution calling for the beginning of a disengagement. I think the most intriguing thing, and the people who may have the most power in this, are Republicans in the Senate. Because I think if the president begins to, and the Senate and the House, but particularly the Senate, which has a big role in foreign policy, if the president begins to lose support among mainstream Republicans, I think it will be very hard politically for him to sustain his policy. He might have the power to do it, but I think it becomes more and more difficult. And you've already seen two senators who are up for re-election in 2008, two Republicans, Norm Coleman of Minnesota, and even more strongly, Gordon Smith of Oregon, people who have supported the president more or less up to now, are becoming very critical because they don't want to run for re-election if an unpopular war is still raging with as few results as we have seen so far.
And what's the common wisdom in Washington this week? Is he going to call next week for an increase in troops, 20,000, 30,000? What do you think?
The common wisdom in Washington, which for some people almost certainly means it's wrong, but the common wisdom in Washington is that he will call for some kind of surge. There are all kinds of surge, which is essentially another word for escalation.
Right.
There is a lot of talk about the numbers, and I don't think there's any clarity about what he's decided. You have, just as you said, you've heard numbers as low as 7,000, as high as 30,000. There's also the question of how long are they going to stay there. Frederick Kagan and a colleague who are the strongest supporters of the surge argue that if you don't keep the troops there for 12 to 18 months, the surge won't work. But our military is saying, we don't have the capacity to keep a big new number of troops in Iraq. So it's a very dicey proposition, and the opposition to those who oppose the surge are saying, look, as we saw in the reaction to the taunting of Saddam Hussein after his execution, and who could imagine that this butcher could look like the dignified person, you know, at the end of such a process, when you see that reaction, you see that the problem in Iraq is finally not military, it's political. And if the Sunni and the Shia cannot figure out some way on their own to reach a political agreement to reduce this violence, I don't think 20,000 American troops can make the difference.
Well, figure in the election here, because Iraq, people were voting on Iraq, and the Democrats won in large measure based on that particular issue. How can the president, in good conscience, go against the will of the American people? I think they're saying, start bringing people home. Don't send more there.
No, I think that's right. And I think that, I mean, I'm, as people who read my column know, I'm not a supporter of the president.
Right.
I think his own rationale is, election or no election, this is what I think is the right thing to do. I don't want to sort of turn back on this war. I still think we have to pursue it to victory, although Lord knows what victory now means. We have already kind of had to define victory down a whole lot. Even the president has had to do that. So that I think his own rationale to himself is, this is the right thing to do. I'm going to do it, election or no election. But obviously in a democratic country, when the voters cast ballots as they did, this was a very large shift. Yes, the Democratic margins, particularly in the Senate, are small, but the Democrats, you know, gained about 6-7 points in the popular vote, if in the House races, for example. So you're talking about a very big shift against the president, and as all the polls suggested, Iraq was a big part of it.
Right.
So it's very difficult for him to do this, but at least theoretically, he's got the power to do it.
We're going to welcome phone calls. And call in early, if you would. We have about 10 more minutes with E.J. Dionne, and then we'll speak with the economics editor for Congressional Quarterly as we look at the Democrats taking power in Congress, which will happen about an hour and a half from now, our time. We have a lot of issues to look at. They, during this first 100 hours, are supposed to look at recommendations from the bipartisan September 11 Commission. The federal minimum wage should go up to $7.25, I believe it is, over the next 2 years. Embryonic stem cell research also on the agenda. The elimination of a prohibition for federal officials negotiating with pharmaceutical companies for lower prices for those who are enrolled in the Medicare program. Cutting the interest rate on federally subsidized loans. Here's our number. Call in. Let's talk with EJ about what your hopes are for the new Congress. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. You hear EJ Dionne frequently offering political commentary on National Public Radio. He writes twice weekly op-ed columns for the Washington Post, and tomorrow's will deal with the issue, as you heard him say, of Iraq. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we're going to talk with a UW Oshkosh professor who served quite a bit of time in federal prison on drug charges. He's now working in Wisconsin prisons, helping inmates get educated. We will speak with him and also with one of his students, who was recently released from prison and plans to start college in the fall. So that's coming up, hour two. E.J. Dionne is with us now, our number 800-486-8655. Scott from Green Bay, hello.
Good morning. I just had two quick questions, I guess, or comments. One of them regarding the war and the surge in troops. I know the press's favorite Republican is John McCain, who is very, very supportive of increasing troop levels. I mean, he's really talked about it quite a bit, and that doesn't seem to be talked about too much. And the second thing is regarding the ethics initiatives by the Democrats, does it hurt them at all with, I think it's William Jefferson, ethics problems that he's got, and then Nancy Pelosi's first attempt to do something, trying to trump Steny Hoyer and putting John Murtha, who from Abscam we know had some ethics problems himself.
Those are all very good questions. Just on the McCain business, the caller's absolutely right. McCain is one of the biggest supporters of the surge. He's also been one of the strongest supporters of the war, in some ways even before President Bush was. One of the questions will be, as the war becomes more unpopular, does this affect Senator McCain's popularity, I was struck that former Senator Edwards was on George Stephanopoulos' ABC show, and he referred to the surge as the McCain doctrine.
Yes,
so he was clearly trying to hang this policy around McCain's neck, and we'll see how it plays out in 2 years. On the third point he made, I personally think it was a mistake for Pelosi to back Murtha for Cindy Hoyer's job, precisely for the reason the caller said, which is Murtha had had his own ethics problems. He had a lot of support from anti-war Democrats because of his strong stand on the war, but Democrats who need to come in to clean things up didn't need all the revisiting of Murtha's past, and I think that's why Hoyer won by such a large margin. On the William Jefferson thing, it will be an embarrassment to the Democrats. There's no question about that. But Nancy Pelosi, before the election, really took her distance from Jefferson and risked some considerable grief from the Black Caucus when she removed him from the Ways and Means Committee. I think a lot of members of the Black Caucus understood that given if you have a member of Congress who is found with $90,000 in his freezer,
right.
It really does
yeah.
not look like the most ethical approach
no.
to governance, whether or not we'll see what happens legally to Mr. Jefferson. So, yes, it'll be an embarrassment, but I think Pelosi has taken some preemptive steps on that already.
Scott, thanks for the call. Rich from Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I called in just to say I think one of the disabilities liberals have is that they're just too nice. They tend to be people who say, well, it might be this, it might be that, we have to listen to this, we have to listen to that. And in communicating that to the public, they come across as Republicans have painted them or us as sort of flip-floppers. And I do understand why Nancy Pelosi, who's third in line for the presidency, would say, well, I'm not going to look at impeachment at all, because we have more important things to accomplish in the country. Nonetheless, I mean, if she did work for impeachment, she would also be working for her own possible presidency, which I do think is sort of unseemly. I don't think liberals are on the attack enough.
EJ, I'm sorry, we're running short on time. EJ.
I suspect the caller is familiar with the line that liberals are people who can't even take their own side in an argument. and so, yes, I think there is some of that's true, although I must say President Bush has brought out a lot of tougher instincts among liberals. I think you see it on the web. You saw it in the advertising in the last election.
Mm-hmm,
you saw
mm-hmm.
it from a lot of candidates. I think the impeachment question is a significant part of a practical question. Number one, there aren't the votes for impeachment. Number two, having lived through the Clinton impeachment, which I thought was thoroughly unjustified, I think that going through, and you'd have to really do a double impeachment of Bush and Cheney if you really wanted to change things, I think putting all your energy in impeachment does not get the job that liberals want done. And I think there are many more effective ways of holding the president accountable. And a lot of the hearings that Democrats are going to be having in the House and Senate are going to build a case against the president. God forbid, if something emerges that there would be a vast majority in the country that would create a majority to support impeachment, that would change the politics of it. But for now, I don't think that's going to happen. But I think impeachment's just not effective. And I think liberals are also sometimes in danger of doing the thing that makes them feel good rather than the thing that is most politically effective. And I think accountability, passing progressive legislation, hearings, public information is the way to change the country in a way that creates a new political
yeah.
and what I would hope more progressive political climate.
EJ, let's spend a moment on the pharmaceutical companies. The Democrats vowing that they want to eliminate this prohibition. Federal officials negotiating with those companies for lower prices for those in the Medicare drug program. Why doesn't somebody take on the pharmaceutical companies? It's my understanding that they have not been investigated by Congress since the 1950s. You know, we need to know what's going on with these companies. First, do you think that that kind of provision will pass? And secondly, will somebody look at this issue of how much money they're making and the cost of pharmaceuticals in this country? They're outrageously high.
I would be willing to bet somebody's prescription drug costs, but please nobody take me up on it in case I'm wrong, that this Congress is going to investigate the pharmaceutical companies.
Mm.
I think they are anticipating that. It's going to happen as this legislation to allow the government to negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceuticals moves through the Congress. I think what you've seen, how effective government negotiation with the companies can be in the way the VA has been able to bring down prices. And, you know, Republicans and supporters, many Republicans and supporters of the pharmaceutical companies say, well, this negotiating process is really a form of price controls. Well, I think you're going to face, you may face price controls as well as negotiation, because government is going to be picking up more and more of the healthcare tab.
Mm-hmm.
As we age as a society. We're going to get closer to universal coverage simply by the aging process as we all go into Medicare. And if the taxpayers are going to pay, the taxpayers are going to want the best prices they can get on these drugs that are necessary for the health of seniors, people on Medicaid. And so I think it's inevitable that it happens. I think it'll be a long struggle because the pharmaceutical companies are powerful. They make a case they need these profits for research. I think there are problems myself. I think there are deep problems with that case. But I think we're going to get there eventually. It's a matter of seeing whether how much this Congress can do on it.
All right. We have about a minute left. The presidential race. Who do you think's the front runner? Who's the most interesting for you to follow right now, the most interesting guy or gal?
Well, I share the conventional wisdom that Barack Obama is the most interesting. I actually met him about 9 years ago when he was a state senator.
Oh, really?
And found him as, you know, intriguing from the start. I think he's a very serious and very smart person. But actually, when you look at the Democratic side this year, I think it's the most interesting array of candidates since the 1960 election, when you had John Kennedy, you had Hubert Humphrey, you had Lyndon Johnson, and a number of other people, Adlai Stevenson in the wings. I think Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards are all very smart, politically gifted people. I think, you know, Hillary Clinton has the advantage that she's, I think, a better politician than people give her credit for, because they compare her always with her husband. On the negative side, she has baggage, so-called, which we won't describe. It all goes back to the Clinton years. Obama, as John Alter wrote in the Newsweek, his problem may be that he doesn't quite have enough baggage yet, but he is a very compelling person.
Yes, he is.
Edwards is one of the most persuasive speakers I've ever heard. And I think he cannot be written off because he is very strong in Iowa, which is the earliest contest. He's also very strong with the unions, who are strong in Nevada, which is now moved up on the primary calendar. Mm-hmm. So I think this is going to be you know, one of the most interesting races the Democrats have seen, as I say, in, I guess, 48 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long time ago.
Interesting and very long.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks so much. I always love listening to you.
You know, I'm sorry I can't stay for the whole hour, but next time when I don't have to write a column, I'd love to join you for the whole hour. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, thanks, EJ. EJ Dionne, our guest, the first part of this program, he is a writer for The Washington Post. He writes twice weekly op-ed columns, and he also, as you know, appears frequently giving political commentary on National Public Radio. He has written several books, Why Americans Hate Politics, published in 91, They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era, which was published in 1996, perhaps that's this era, who knows, and his third book, Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge, published in 2004. We're going to continue our talk about the Democrats being sworn in at 11 o'clock today, our time. And what their first 100 hours, which I guess, according to the New York Times yesterday, will start next Tuesday and not today because they have other things going on. They have orientation sessions, although they are to be looking at some ethics issues, I believe, tomorrow. So we'll talk about what it means for them to be in control. We're just changing guests for the next half hour of the program to Jody Schneider, who's economics editor of Congressional Quarterly, and welcoming your phone calls. They're still pertinent this half hour, so the number is 800-486-8655. Jody, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Hi. So now, is it true that they're going to maybe look at some ethics tomorrow, but the first 100 hours really start next week?
Well, no, they start this week.
Oh, it will?
Yes, they start this week, but they're going to do the ethics portion today and tomorrow, and actual legislation they're going to start on next week, the 9/11 Commission report items, things like the minimum wage, those will start taking place next week. But the 100 hours start.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at something we haven't talked about yet, and that is the recommendations from the September 11 Commission. Do you imagine that these are going – well, first of all, what are those recommendations? Are there a long list of them that never made it out of the last session of Congress? Will those pass pretty easily?
Well, getting to the House and getting to the Senate are going to be two different things for many pieces of legislation. The House Democrats next week are going to press to implement some of these recommendations, some of the more controversial ones, including more risk-based Homeland Security funding, cargo security inspections, and grants for what we call first responder communication systems, all of which were in the report. They are expected to get through the House, but then whether they will be able to do so in the Senate is a whole other issue. The debate over how, for instance, to distribute first responder grants to cities and states was a big fight between the House and the Senate in 2005 when they differed over how to deal with the funding formula for who got what. So, and I think we're going to see this in a lot of these things, that the House, you know, now that it's heavily Democratic and that they've got a majority, is going to be able to get through some of these things pretty quickly. And because of the big push, the Senate, which moves at a more deliberate pace, but is also very split closely between the parties, and also because of Senate rules, which really, because of the filibuster in the Senate, for controversial things, you almost always need 60 votes. Not 60 votes, you know, in the Senate, more than 50% in the House is all you need. So I think we're going to see some things race through the House and then maybe sit in the Senate.
What about the tactics being used? The Republicans are criticizing the Democrats for resorting to some of the tactics the Republicans have used, right? Yeah, exactly. How can you do this?
Perfected. What do you mean?
when they're saying, the Republicans are saying, hey, the election showed that we need to work together.
Right. Well, I think the Democrats are saying, sure, we want to work together, but, you know, we don't necessarily want your amendments. I think we're going to see, you know, the Democrats are in charge now. There's got to be a little bit of this pent up. You know, it's our
12 turn. Years. Yeah.
12 years, a long time. And also, I think what the Democrats are saying is, well, we're not going to do some of the more egregious kinds of things you did, like cut us out of conference committees. I mean, they were barely in the conferences. We're not going to pass legislation in the middle of the night without a chance to read it, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I think that they're going to operate the House Rules Committee with a pretty partisan fist, if you will. And, I mean, even in these first ethics, you know, the House rules changes that are expected to start coming up this afternoon after they're all sworn in, Louise Slaughter, who's the new head of the House Rules Committee, is not accepting any amendments. You know, it's as they're written is how they will go to the floor.
The one that seems to, from what I've read, stand the greatest chance of being passed both in the House and the Senate fairly quickly is the minimum wage.
Right. Yes, I think that's that's one of the things that they're going to do. I was a little surprised they didn't do it first, but I guess they want to do these ethics things to show that they're cleaning up Washington. That has to be that was the message of the election, so they want to do that first. But the minimum wage is certainly atop their agenda, and in the House they're really not going to have a problem passing it. It raises the minimum wage over 2 years by $2.10 an hour. Of course, a lot of states already have a higher minimum wage, which is interesting, but this would be the federal law. The Senate, when they take it up, and we're not having a real sense of when things are going to come up in the Senate, but by mid-January, the Senate should be wrestling with the minimum wage bill. Republicans have already said they will not permit it to pass without some kind of small business tax and regulatory breaks. The White House has said they would support the minimum wage increase with those things for small businesses. So I think that's going to be the debate there.
Mm-hmm. Stem cell research.
Stem cell research is another one that is in, you know, the 100 hours queue, if you will. And this one's going to be a little tricky because, you know, this was the one bill that Bush vetoed in his, six years of office now. And so the Republicans are going to be in a position, I think, where they're going to be, you know, fairly supportive of the White House stance. And this also raises the question now of what we're going to see from the White House because, they haven't found the veto pen very often so far. I think they're going to be finding it a lot more now, and they're going to be sending a lot more of what we call saps, which are statements of administration policy, which often contain veto threats in them. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to see a more activist White House. Before, what the White House had done is they told the Republicans what they wanted them to send up to the Hill, and the Republicans, you know, tried to do it. Now it's going to be, they're really going to have to be deciding which things that they're going to actually veto.
Yeah, meaning that we're not going to see a lot happen?
I think we're going to see a fair amount happen. I think we're going to see a fair amount of legislation get passed. You know, especially with they've come out and said in our first 100 days we're going to do all these things. So they are 100 hours. So they really have to. The question is then, does it become law? Does the Senate pass it? And what is the White House going to do? And then in some of these things, stem cell, for instance, to override a veto is difficult.
Mm-hmm. This will affect a lot of people, and I'm wondering what kind of Republican support there is for this. It seems as though it would be quite popular with the American public to cut the interest rate on federally subsidized student loans.
Mm-hmm. That's something Barbara Mikulski from Maryland has talked about, and some other folks. The student loan, that will be coming up. You then get into, with that, another situation, I hate to sound like a broken record, in the Senate, whether they're going to have problems mm-hmm. there with that. Again, because it is so closely divided, the Republicans, I think, are going to try to give the Democrats a hard time on their legislation. This is how they're going to be able to make their stand, is over in the Senate, where they are really closer to the majority than they are in the House, where they're really in the majority.
And they wouldn't want to cut federally subsidized student loans for what reason?
Well, I think there's some business reasons, and this is the business lobby has weighed in on this, and I think that becomes the issue.
What about Iraq? I read this figure the other day that it's $8 billion a month that we're spending in Iraq. Is that correct?
We're spending a ton of money in Iraq, and we're going to get another, one of the first things that's going to come down the pike here on Iraq, interestingly, is White House is going to be sending, it's expected to send a supplemental appropriations request, for Iraq in the neighborhood of $100 billion come February. And I don't think either chamber is going to have had enough time to wrestle with Iraq issues before then. The first thing they're going to be doing is spending a lot more money on Iraq. I think they will use that as an opportunity to rail against the war and say something needs to be done. But also, perhaps this time, there had been some talk of it with the last supplemental, but perhaps this time to actually tie some restrictions, on the spending of the money and on also benchmarks. Trying to mm-hmm. To require some benchmarks, sort of strings attached with the money. Mm-hmm. But this is, as you point out, this is the huge issue for the Republican, for the Democrats,
right.
And they need to make some. They're going to need to do something pretty soon,
right.
Because again, I think the public's going to say, "Well, we elected you on this issue,
right?
We elected you on this and ethics." So they're running out of right out of the box. They're going to deal with ethics, but then what about Iraq? And
yeah.
I think that's where that's going to be where we're going to be seeing. I think we're going to be probably seeing hearings, or we're going to be seeing a lot of talk, but what they do in terms of legislation on Iraq is still anybody's guess.
Well, what do you think will happen? The president, and I could be wildly wrong here, but the indications are that the president next week will call for an increase in troops, 20,000, 30,000, and then the Democrats will respond in what way? It's not going to be a popular idea among the American people. What will the Democrats do? What could they do in terms of the purse string, in terms of not letting that policy go forward?
Right. Well, I think they're going to have to come up with another policy, too.
Right.
I don't think it's going to be enough. I don't think the American public wants there to be just a, no, we don't like your ideas anymore, Mr. President. Well, we have an expensive war over there. What is the plan? So I think that, and the Democrats had said, they are going to come up with a plan on Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to do something. What it is, remains to be seen. But I think it's going to have to be more than playing defense. I think the strings that they're going to try to attach to the money are things like benchmarks showing, are we doing certain things in terms of troop levels? Are we doing certain things in terms of perhaps the citizenry over there? What are the things that we're doing as we spend this money? But, it's the same problem. Everybody is facing this problem, we are there.
Right.
Getting out of there is going to be very difficult. Once you decide that you want to leave, that's fine. But how do you do that? How do you do that into the current situation? And how do you do that? How do you set up a timetable for doing so?
Yeah.
And then they're going to have to do this quickly because really they've got this year to legislate. Next year starts becoming a political, it's an election year for
mm-hmm.
them,
mm-hmm.
both the House and the Senate, and it's a presidential election
mm-hmm.
year. And so they're going to be caught up in that whole storm of rhetoric. And as we know, in election years, very little legislating actually goes on. It's much more politicking.
Jody Schneider is with us this half hour, economics editor for Congressional Quarterly. We're looking at the 110th session of Congress, which officially begins with the Democratic majority in the House and the Senate being sworn in today at 11 o'clock our time. The issues that they're going to be taking up the first 100 hours, what the Democrats could do about Iraq, what the Republicans, what the president is planning to do about Iraq, and what kinds of changes could happen in the next couple of years. We certainly welcome your phone calls now. All our lines are open, so grab a line, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. I guess the overall question for you is, what do you expect from a Congress now that is in control of the Democrats? If you voted that way, if you voted for change, what were you looking for? What kind of change do you hope to see? We'll take your phone calls as they come in. Don't be shy. Let's talk about this, okay? It's a big day. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we're going to be talking with a professor from the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh who served a federal prison sentence. And 20 years after his release, is back in the classroom, of course, and back in prisons. He's a tenured professor at Oshkosh and leads a national movement of some three dozen ex-convicts with advanced degrees who are advocating for change in the criminal justice system and hoping to convince some people who are in that system right now that education can change their lives when they leave prison. We'll also talk with a young man who was incarcerated on drug charges for quite some time. He was recently released, and he plans to start college, I believe, at UW-Oshkosh in the spring. So that's coming up. Welcoming phone calls now as we look at the 110th session of Congress. Jody Schneider is our guest, economics editor for Congressional Quarterly, and we have phone lines open. What do you expect from this session of Congress? What do you hope will happen? What are the issues that are most important to you? What do you think of the Democrats taking the first 100 hours to look at the federal minimum wage and drug prices, negotiating with pharmaceutical companies, and the September 11 Commission report and those and stem cell research they've targeted for legislation they want to take on immediately? And what about the war in Iraq? We certainly welcome your phone calls. Joe from Wausau, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I think the recent botched election of Saddam Hussein is further evidence that we can't count on the Iraqi people to straighten things out themselves. And I think we should withdraw from that country as quickly as we can. I have often said we should give it back to Saddam, but that can't happen anymore.
Mm-hmm. Judy?
Is there a question? I guess I'm...
Yeah. It strikes me as though the overriding issue still is Iraq, and it seems to me as though we don't know exactly where we're going with it, Lily, and it's a very unsettling way to start a new year, and the execution was unsettling, and the money's unsettling, and the deaths, I should have put that first, are extremely unsettling, that we want some kind of movement here, and I think it will trouble the American people for the next year or for the year thereafter to not see some change in our policy here.
No, I think you're right. I think that there is that this was the message of the election. I mean, and the president has acknowledged that, everybody's acknowledged it, and yet there is, you look at this first 100 legislative hours and all the fanfare of that, and there's no Iraq there.
Right.
And it's going to be, I think this highlights that this is going to be a very thorny issue. This is not something they're going to, the Democrats are going to be able to fix quickly. But I do think there's a ticking clock on them on this. And if they don't make this a priority within their first few months of office and put a plan out there, I think they may be seeing sharp reversals at the polls
mm-hmm.
in 2008.
Jody, how did the Democrats decide what issues would be part of that first 100 hours?
This was very much Nancy Pelosi and her leadership team. I think these are some of these are obviously Democratic priorities, things they wanted to do for a while, like minimum wage. The ethics, I think they wanted to do, you know, to send a signal that they're going to clean up Washington. Other things like the stem cells, I think that's kind of, you know, saying to the administration, you know, you vetoed our legislation. Well, here we're gonna undo that. We're gonna try to undo that veto. And then things like the student loans and allowing the government to negotiate lower prices on prescription drugs for Medicare recipients are kind of things that they think are speaking to the populace.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls for Jordy at 800-486-8655. We go to Al from Madison next. Hi, Al.
Hi. I'm a Vietnam vet, and I would like to save 3,000 to 5,000 American lives. And the way we do that is to remove the president, to remove the vice president, because they are determined to keep the troops and keep the fighting going on for many more years. And, yes, impeachment is awful, difficult, but losing 5,000 to 10,000 American lives and many casualties and many destroyed marriages is far worse. So when a surge idea comes up, or which is not a surge, it's an escalation, I hope, and I'll be among the folks that will start anti-war protests and start to get this president out by summer. It doesn't look like it now, but when they want to send more over there, I think that the country is going to start going that direction.
Do you see that on the table at all for the session, the Democrats in control or not, Jody?
No, I really don't. Mm-hmm. One of the things, I mean, I think impeachment is not on the table, certainly.
Yeah.
And even one of the things that got some discussion during the campaign was whether there would be hearings into Bush and the Bush administration's conduct of the Iraq War. And Nancy Pelosi, one of the first things that she said after the election was that they were not going to spend a lot of time going over what had already happened, that they're going to look at oversight of the war going forward, but that she made it clear that she didn't want to spend a lot of their political capital and their time on that. So I think what it is now is, you know, people are going to be focused on what do we do about the war instead of holding the Bush administration, you know, basically looking at what happened and trying to take some kind of action against the administration.
So you don't think there will be hearings on the intelligence and how the intelligence was maybe manipulated or how what kind of intelligence we were using to go to war? They're not going to take on that kind of investigation?
Well, I think they'd be looking at things like intelligence, those kinds of things. But I don't think there had been calls for hearings into, you know, Bush and the, you know, Cheney and what they
yes.
knew when and, you know, that kind of thing, much more kind of punitive, mm-hmm. You know, toward them. And I don't think we're going to see that. I think we are going to see, you know, an exploration of an intelligence because, you know, I think there's still going to be a lot of look at our whole intelligence system and in terms of, you know, the war on terror generally,
right.
Not just Iraq.
Thanks, Al, for your call. Let's go to Alan from Platteville next. Hi, Alan.
Hi, ma'am. How are you this morning?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing good. Really, it's kind of a question and a comment. You had mentioned earlier in the program that maybe Congress and the Senate should investigate the pharmaceutical companies this year. But, you know, I just had a friend pass away a couple weeks ago, and they had spent 10 days in intensive care, and you're looking at a hospital bill that's in the thousands. She got medevaced to another hospital that was 30 miles away, and that helicopter ride cost $17,000 for a half hour.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, a prescription drug that you go get, I don't know, I'm not on any prescription medication, so I don't even know what the average cost is, but isn't that really just kind of scratching the surface, really, of a whole encompassing problem?
Well, people pay a lot of money for prescription drugs, though, particularly older people. I'm looking at the disparity in the cost between American drug companies and drug companies in other parts of the world as well. We spent some time with E.J. Dionne talking about this. Jody, you want to weigh in on – I know they're going to look at whether or not the federal government should be able to negotiate lower prices for Medicare. You want to take on that issue? We also talked briefly about whether or not the whole pharmaceutical industry should be investigated.
Right. Well, I think there are two things there. First of all, the House in its 100 hours is going to do is expected to pass a bill that would allow the government to negotiate lower prices on prescription drugs for Medicare recipients. And Senate Democrats are going to debate a bill that would essentially rewrite the 2003 Medicare prescription drug bill. again, allowing the government to negotiate bulk prices.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans and Bush have opposed this consistently, and some have said it's because they are favoring the pharmaceutical companies and you know, don't want to cut into their profits. So the drug issue, I think, is tied somewhat to the whole, you know, larger pharmaceutical issue. I don't think there's going to be big hearings into the pharmaceutical industry. I think what the Democrats are trying to do is to deal with some issues that affect a lot of people. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about health care prices and how, you know, they're out of control. Employers are having a problem with this. It's not just an individual issue anymore. But I think that, again, the Democrats are trying to say, we are going to try to do some things that we can do something about initially rather than, and I think everybody's still stung from the, you know, during the Clinton administration, they were going to overhaul health care
and
come up with a whole new plan,
mm-hmm.
and it went down in flames. And I don't think anybody wants to touch an overall health care proposal now, not this close to a presidential election year.
Mm-hmm. So let's just put it off for another 10 years,
yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. that's what, I mean, that and Social Security, you know, the big cost, big you know, issues that affect businesses and government and individuals are the things that you see happen piecemeal through the legislative process.
Thanks, Ellen. Let's go to Pat from La Crosse next. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I was curious about budgeting in that my understanding is that the Congress's, one of the Congress's best powers in terms of the war is that they hold the purse strings. And I know that Bush is going to be presenting his budget soon, and in the past he has never put the war costs in that budget. And I'm curious if the Congress can insist that war costs be a part of his budget.
Yeah, that's a good question. And you're right. They have done the war off budget. And so it kind of counts off budget when you're trying, when you look at reducing the deficit. And Bush yesterday came out and said he wants a balanced budget in 5 years. But what he didn't say was how he was going to figure the war costs in that. So, you know, there's been a lot of sort of smoke and mirrors with the war costs in terms of budgeting. First of all, what's actually going to happen? The president will submit his budget February 5th. It is not expected to include the war costs. They are still expected to come across as a supplemental appropriations request that will come around the same time as the budget. But there is going to be a lot of discussion with the Democrats saying we want these to include this, make these on budget, that these will not that is one of the big discussion points. Whether they can get that through, and particularly whether they can get that through in the Senate, is a real issue. But I think that is one of the stands the Democrats are going to take, that they, that the costs of the war start being made much more transparent.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pat, for your call. And let's talk just a little bit about what they're taking up today and tomorrow. How significant, how wide-ranging are these new ethical rules?
Yes, well, they kind of come in three different forms. There's the ones that are going to affect House members and their staff can accept. They would be prohibited from accepting gifts or meals from lobbyists or private organizations that have lobbyists. Members could not participate in travel financed, planned, or arranged by lobbyists or their organizations. Trips financed by private organizations not connected with lobbying you'd have to receive pre-approval. Lawmakers would have to receive pre-approval. That's sort of one category, and that's a big change. You know, before they were able to, as long as they disclosed it, they were able to, you know, go on anybody's plane, you know, for a legislative reason that they wanted to. A second area is what they're not allowed to do in terms of their own, you know, managing of their offices. They're not allowed to use, they would not be allowed to use their office allowances, personal funds, or campaign funds to pay for travel on non-commercial corporate aircraft other than charter planes, and they could not use their influence to coerce a private organization to make decisions on the basis of political affiliation, the sort of trading favors for votes. And they'd also have to participate in annual ethics training,
mm-hmm.
which I'd love to be a fly on the wall when they have that. And then the third area is what we're calling earmarks overhaul. These are the often placed quietly in bills at the last minute member projects, what some people call pork projects. These would not limit them per se, but they would require that the sponsors of them, the lawmaker who is sponsoring them, and their beneficiaries, who was going to benefit,
mm-hmm.
You know, which is sometimes a whole town, but sometimes it's an individual company, and it would also require a justification that those be given for all, not only spending bills, but authorization bills and tax bills.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times in recent years, tax bills have become sort of these earmark-laden measures as well. That would require that. And then the other thing that goes along with that is what we call pay-as-you-go budget enforcement rules, which require that all new mandatory spending and all new tax tax cuts, that would, you know, essentially cost the Treasury money, be offset, that they find a way to pay for it in the budget.
Jody, thanks so much for being with us here again. You're a great guest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jody Schneider, economics editor for Congressional Quarterly. We also thank E.J. Dionne for being with us the first half hour of our program, looking at the 110th session of Congress. They will be sworn in today at 11 o'clock our time and start work with ethics legislation and more legislation being taken up seriously on Tuesday of next week. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll return with more Thursday conversation. Should be a very interesting hour ahead, so please stay with us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.